Welcome to the She Births Show, a place to inspire your birth, evolve your parenting, and help you live a life you love. I'm Nadine Richardson, your host and creator of the scientifically verified birth education program, She Births. I'm also a mother, yoga teacher, doula, author, and speaker. At She Births, we have supported thousands of families around the world for over 13 years with our unique program, and our vision is to make birth better for every family around the world, so that everyone experiences a beautiful birth no matter what unfolds. Not only do we help people have beautiful births, but we also give them the skills and the philosophy to enjoy pregnancy and make parenting easier, as well as our world-class birth ed, taken either face-to-face or online. In our app, we also have a free pregnancy guide designed to help you feel calm, connected, and inspired as you and your baby grow. We have a doula matching service, the perfect way to ensure you and your partner are completely supported throughout the whole journey. And we have our Soul Mama Circles, which are the perfect postpartum network to help optimize your mindset and design your life in parenthood. Remember, if you like what you hear today, subscribe, share with a friend, and leave us a review. If you're a parent, about to be one, fellow health professional, join us now for an inspirational deep dive into topics with experts around the globe. We hope you enjoy this special episode. Hello, and thank you for joining me for today's podcast. Whether you are pregnant, you've got a baby in your arms or a child at school, whether you are a birth worker or an allied health practitioner, I know you're going to find this conversation very interesting. I believe it's important to have conversations with people who think differently, especially those who are curious, especially people who speak their mind and research outside of the mainstream narrative. Dr. Stuart Fishbein has been an obstetrician in America since 1986. After working at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in California in standard medical models, he now practices community-based birthing and works directly with home birthing midwives through birthinginstincts.com. You can find them there and their podcast. Birthing Instincts offers hope for those women who prefer and respect a natural birthing environment and cannot find supportive practitioners for VBAC, twin, or breech deliveries. Dr. Stu is an outspoken advocate of informed decision making, the midwifery model of care, and human rights in childbirth. He received the 2016 Most Audacious Award from HRIC, Human Rights in Childbirth Community, and he's won other awards and written peer-reviewed papers as well. He's spoken internationally on breech and vaginal birth after cesarean section. He's also appeared in many documentaries, including More Business of Being Born, Happy Healthy Child, Reducing Infant Mortality, Heads Up, The Disappearing Art of Vaginal Breech Delivery, and has multiple YouTube videos discussing birth choices and respect for patient autonomy and decision-making. He still actively cares for pregnant women while teaching hands-on seminars, and he's coming out to Australia soon, on breech birth. He has the goal of improving collaboration amongst the differing professions in the birthing world and reteaching core skills such as breech and twin vaginal birth that make the speciality of obstetrics unique. So I'm going to give you a little introduction, I suppose, because, you know, She Births isn't just about information, tools and techniques and so on. It's a philosophy. Every parent that I ever meet who has done She Births, and I just taught a course this weekend and had a couple that came to my house here in Byron to prepare for their third birth, and they did the course in Sydney with their first birth. And, you know, it changes you for life, this birth preparation, because it's a philosophy and birth changes our brains, as does parenting. And so we're adapting to a new way of seeing the world throughout this journey of matrescence and patrescence. So I suppose I want to preface this conversation by reminding us all that we're all walking around with our own personal perceptions of truth. We all project these beliefs and judgments onto the world continually. And during birth, we often experience this from the system, their projections. But if we're smart, we realize that the pressure is truly coming back to us to find out what we really believe in and what we want for ourselves and our babies, and so that we can communicate that clearly. One of the most challenging conversations I have during She Births courses is informing people that your body is your own. Sounds obvious, but it's not a lot of the time in healthcare. Only you can decide what to do with it, even during pregnancy and birth. Nobody will ever be able to take responsibility for yours or your baby's health. Certainly, no one will ever think about it as much as you do. No one will care about your experiences as much as you do. No one is living it, of course, and no one is going to live with those consequences except for you. The second uncomfortable truth that is that so-called evidence-based care is a term that gets bandied about a lot. I think in search of status, of course, and prestige, and to provide a sense of safety, but it also sometimes commands a sense of power or power over. In truth, healthcare actually varies from practitioner to practitioner, from hospital to hospital, from country to country. So in broadening our awareness and seeing this reality, we can actually start to explore new ways and craft a unique and satisfying path for our family. In today's conversation with Dr. Stu, I explore how the medico-industrial complex is more likely to be influencing the policy and therefore the suggestions that trickle down into advice, maybe even coercion, that is given to women during pregnancy and birth. There are different policies that flow to us as consumers from, say, the private company that owns the hospital that you're birthing at, as to whether you are allowed to birth in water, for example, and I use that word allowed in inverted commas, or an insurance company that covers an obstetrician may be the actual determining factor as to whether you are even offered the opportunity to have a VBAC, a vaginal birth after cesarean. So we all need to find our own way in life, especially with our health and our birth. Often this pregnancy and birth parenting time is a time with so many decisions. It can be really intense and overwhelming, but it's a big initiation into sovereignty, into power, our own power. We all need to realize that we are responsible for us and no one is coming. We need to do our own research. We need to choose. And just because somebody says so does not make it so for you. In my experience, I love to do lots of reading and lots of researching and lots of asking around. And then when I get to the point when I'm totally confused and the books and the research papers are all starting to contradict each other, I know that I've gone down enough rabbit holes. And then at the end of the day, when I get into bed at night, all I have is me, my choices, my inner feeling or gnosis, my knowing, or my intuition. Now, intuition is heightened as a pregnant woman, as a mother, and as a partner. And that's our theme this season, intuition. And last week's podcast explained how intuition is actually the parental brain working perfectly, because so many pathways have changed within the brain during this time. And you can go into the details of that in last week's podcast. I highly recommend it. I believe that intuition is going to be one of the most important and the most guiding factors that we can utilize now going forward in this modern world. The brain cannot possibly hold all the information we would like it to, especially in this age of information. we are bombarded with information and echo chambers. We have to trust our innate intelligence and natural wisdom in our bodies and hearts, as well as the pros and cons list or the data. And sometimes we really need to question where that data comes from and follow the money. So right now, in this age of misinformation and disinformation, and the powers that be continually try to confuse us and divide us, we're going to have to come back to ourselves and to acceptance and compassion for all others. So that's a long introduction, I understand, but I just felt like I had to get it off my chest because I can feel it bubbling up in the kind of consciousness, and it does come into play in this pregnancy and birth conversation, I suppose. It can be confronting what we talk about today. We talk about the medico-industrial complex, how informed consent is not able to happen in the current model of healthcare, medical induction and the reality, inverted commas, of due dates, and the impact of the ARRIVE trial, the origins of that ARRIVE trial, and why it's still sticking, natural breech births and other so-called high-risk mums being offered more choice, the risks of having multiple ultrasounds, and the label of things like growth restriction, and realizing that we need to redefine risk because it's already been redefined through maternal fetal medicine. How continuous monitoring of labor and tracking the time of a woman's labor will increase C-section rates, or has increased C-section rates. Finally, my favorite part is leaning into that vision of hope, because I did shed a few tears. It just all started to become a little bit grim at some point, but I did enjoy the Star Wars analogy that Stu came up with. I feel like right now there is a desperate need for more birth support and more birth education. It's time to democratize and hand power and knowledge back to mothers and their partners. So if you feel passionate like I do, if you want to help families have better births, then reach out and join me in one of our upcoming trainings. It's almost finalized. We're getting so close to launch. But if you want to be the first to know, then make sure you're on our email list or sign up to the Educator Training Doula Guide Training on the website. I will also be running a Wise Woman retreat up here in the Byron area towards the end of the year, because this is what we need more of, more wisdom. And I also have a Soul Mama Circle starting in the Byron area very soon. So if you'd want to join that, check it out on the website. You'll love meeting like-minded people and sharing this journey of wisdom and intuition reclamation in community. I love hearing from you. Please leave us a review, send me an email, let us know what you feel, what you think, and what you need. I send you lots of love across the ethers. Dr. Stu, welcome to the She Births Show.
Good afternoon, good evening, good middle of the night, and good tomorrow to you.
Tomorrow is a really good day here.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah. But unfortunately, shit's still happening. But we're here. We made it. It's a good place. Yeah.
It looks sunny where you are. I can see all the windows behind
you. Yeah. And it's literally been raining for weeks. My garden is like out of control. It's like a jungle here.
And you're in Sydney.
No, I was. I go between the two. At the moment, I'm up in Byron Bay. Yeah. Uh-huh. And you're coming. You're coming to Australia.
Yeah, I'm coming for about 5 weeks, mid-August.
And why are you coming? Why are you coming all the way down under, Stu?
You know, I don't know. No, I do know. I'm coming because of, I was initially invited to speak at the Rebellious Midwives Conference in Sydney. And then some of the local midwives there, Mel and some other people, invited me to do some seminars, my 2-day Reteach Breech seminar. And then it's just started to spread, and I'm going to actually probably start in Adelaide and then come to Sydney and then go to Gold Coast and then up to Brisbane and then end in Melbourne.
I think we have you here too. Like, we're near the Gold Coast, so you're coming here as well.
Yeah, there's one in Gold Coast, but not one else. I don't know. Listen, I got people. I got a person. I don't have people. I sound too big when I say I have people. I have person.
You have Emily.
Yes, I have Emily, who organizes this all for me. and keeps me pointed in the right direction. But I'm coming because there's a big interest, at least in the midwifery community, of learning these skills, even though midwives are often forbidden from doing this.
Yeah.
They still have the desire to be a competent birth worker, birth practitioner. And you can't be attending births, in all honesty, if you don't know about breech delivery, about twin delivery. You can't just be sectioning everybody. They are, but you can't, that you can't consider yourself a full-fledged obstetrician. And yet obstetricians don't usually attend these things. They're not interested because of limitations on what they're allowed to do in their own environment, their own hospital systems and settings, because the rules are not set by individual doctors or midwives anymore.
Yeah.
They're set by, you know, the big mucky mucks who make the big salaries and tell you what to do at 2 a.m. while they're home sleeping. And so it's a situation where I just think that you have to have these skills, because every now and then somebody's going to show up with the feet sticking out of the vagina. And if you don't know what to do in that situation, and all your only option is to shove the baby back up inside and make the mom blow and try to get her up to the operating theater and put her under general anesthesia. And by the time that all happens, you're going to have probably a pretty bad outcome. And yet a well-trained physician, if the woman is completely dilated and the feet are sticking out, can have that baby out in about 12 seconds.
I've heard those stories, even at our local Royal Hospital, Randwick, in the birth center, when there's an undiagnosed breech, there's just absolute panic stations. Exactly what you just explained happens generally.
And I love to come to your country. I've been there only once before, and I really can't say that I was in Sydney for 4 days. So that's like somebody saying they came to New York and they went to Miami. And they were there for 4 days and they saw America. It doesn't work that way. So, I've always wanted to spend some time in Australia, and I have, and other than the United States, our biggest following for our podcast is in Australia. So, it's kind of nice to come home to Australia, which would be fun for me to do. Yeah. And that's why, I really look forward to the traveling. I don't look so forward so much to the traveling. I look forward to being there though.
Yeah. And so your main kind of work here will be reteaching breech, twins delivery, vaginally, VBAC management. What are you leaning into?
Well, VBAC management isn't anything special, so we don't really talk much about it. I use it as examples of some medical tyranny or some statistical trickery, but we don't really talk about VBAC, because VBAC is just a normal vaginal delivery. It doesn't require any special skill. It's always lumped in with breech and twins, but it shouldn't be. We're going to do that. And then I have some lectures on sort of almost like the psychology of why the medical model is the way it is. And then I have a detailed lecture on informed consent. Not that everybody doesn't know what that means, but I don't think people really understand what the terminology means. People will throw out terms like standard of care or evidence-based medicine or anything like that. And I don't think they mean what people think they mean.
No.
And what does high risk mean? What does it mean?
I don't know. More likely to have a higher morbidity mortality rate for mom and baby? Is that right?
Yeah,
is that-
more likely, but more likely than what? I mean, is twice a number make a woman high risk when the number is really small in the first place?
That's right. Exactly.
So, you know, what we talk about is that high risk is not really a number at all. It's whatever makes the obstetrician uncomfortable.
That's right.
And then it's claimed to be high risk, but it really isn't high risk if you actually look at the numbers, because some of the things that they accept and do all the time have far greater chance of something abnormal happening than some of the things that they label high risk. So it's just a way of skewing people down a path that you want them to take. And so this is one of the things I talk about. You know, I've had a lot of time to think about this stuff. My journey has been such that I never would have seen myself 40 years ago, you know, where I am now. And I don't think most doctors would ever end up on a path that I ended up on, and I have very little say over a lot of it. But I couldn't be happier that the twists and turns of my life turned me to the point where I am now, and I'm able to advocate for something I truly believe in. I don't have to mince my words. I don't have any masters. I'm not employed by anybody. I don't take insurance. I am licensed in a couple of states here in the United States, but since I'm not currently actively practicing, they have no hold over me on what I say. I mean, California actually did pass a law. It got overturned by the state Supreme Court, but it did pass a law that said that doctors can't speak freely. They have to push the party line. I think you've had that in Australia too. Doctors
got
in trouble.
We have APRA. Yeah, APRA is very scary in the letters that they send out, not just to doctors, but also naturopaths and chiropractors. And we've really seen that over the last few years. Yeah.
I don't know what's in the brain of the legislators that passed this sort of thing, but the idea that you could trust any physician to give you proper information when they're told that if they give this information, they could be censored or lose their license. That makes all physicians information suspect.
Yeah, there is no informed consent then.
Right. The consent process is completely skewed and thrown out the window because doctors need to be able to speak freely about their opinions. And one of the things that's bugged me a lot for the poor nursing profession and the poor OB profession, especially, they go through all this training, years of training. They come out, they take exams, they get board certified or they get nursing board certified. And then they come out after 8 years of training in medical school. I don't know how many in nursing, but it's 3, 4, 5 years in nursing. CNM's probably 5 or 6. And they come out and then they can't practice freely. They're being told how to practice by risk management lawyers and by administrators. I often wonder why anyone would go to medical school who has a shepherd mentality. In other words, somebody who wants to be captain of the ship. Because in my era, and I do sound like an old guy now because I actually have become an old guy. But in my era, you know, the best and the brightest wanted to go to medical school because you could get out, you could make a lot of money, and you ran your own practice. And we were a bit arrogant and egotistical, and maybe some still are, but I don't know why they would be anymore. They're essentially, a lot of them are just employees, and they're cogs in a wheel doing what they're told. And if you want to be a shepherd, you wouldn't want that job.
Mm.
If you're a sheep and just want to, you know, work a shift and get paid a salary and not really get involved in the individualization of care for people and not really take responsibility for things, then medicine might be perfect for you.
Yeah, I wonder if we're going to see like a stream of Netflix documentaries over the next sort of decade as we watch the C-section data climb, like the climate data. You know, we've seen all these different angles and takes on the pain medication kind of corruption and big pharma. I wonder if someone could actually make a documentary about this medico-industrial complex. It is actually pretty complex for the average person to actually understand, and it's actually pretty confronting as well.
You know, if you go back in time and you just rewatch The Business of Being Born.
Yeah.
Exactly. They were, you know, Abby and Ricky were way ahead of their time.
They were 15 years ago. It was the week, I think it was the same month I launched SheBirth. So, yeah, we still promote it. And I noticed,
They talk about the business of medicine and how it interferes with the ability of women to, you know, have the outcomes that they want. You know, we have rising C-section rates, rising induction rates, rising postpartum depression rates, rising epidural rates, you know, rising chronic illness rates in children.
Yeah.
And we're supposed to trust our healthcare to the same people that got us here.
Mm. Yeah.
This is the definition of insanity.
Yeah.
And that's where we are. It was like in my country in 2008 and 2009, we had a big banking crisis, probably affected around the world, but the banks were forced to give loans to people who didn't qualify and couldn't probably pay them back because Washington, D.C. passed a law that said it's not fair that poor people can't own houses without, you know, again, this is called stage one thinking, right? Because they say, well, we need to help these poor people, but they never ask the second question, which is, and then what happens? Well, we found out what happened in 2008 and 2009, but the legislation that forced banks to do this was sponsored by two Maine congressmen, Chris Dodd and Barney Frake. And after the crash, the government said, okay, now we're going to tighten up and we're going to fix all these things and we're going to never let this happen again. And who do they put in charge of that? Chris Dodd and Barney Frank. Same two guys. So if you expect that the problems that you just expressed about the C-section rates and other things like that are going to get resolved by the same people who are causing them, I have news for you. That's not going to happen.
I know, but many, many women are faced with such dilemmas and very tough choices now as people understand more about the influence of in the state and insurance companies and all that kind of stuff influencing their birth. They're really limited with choices as well. That is a problem. And in my area where I am, as a sort of result of that, we get a lot of free birthing women, you know, which has big risks attached to it as well, obviously. It's tough. It's tough.
You know, it's a good question. I mean, I, as a practitioner, have a hard time endorsing free birth, but I support women who make that choice simply because I understand it. But the truth is are the outcomes from free birth, if you did it on a population-based study, are they actually worse than outcomes in the hospital? And I would almost guarantee you that they're not. I would guarantee you that hospital-based birth where you're observed from start to finish and intervened upon from start to finish, your outcomes are probably going to be worse overall than if you have a bad outcome every now and then at a free birth. But women are forced into that, as you said, because they don't have choices. There's nothing wrong with their body. There's nothing wrong with their baby. There's nothing wrong with the process. What's wrong is the lack of choices. And the reason they're anxious is not because anything's really wrong. It's because fear has been projected upon them by the medical model. Whether intentionally or whether inadvertently, fear is the greatest motivator. And you can get anybody to do anything if you frighten them enough. Mm-hmm. And what we've done to the women of the Western world in the last 50 or 70 years is to tell them that their bodies don't work anymore and that without medicine, that you're going to have a disaster. Yes. And so that's where we ended up at a point where everybody thinks they need medical care to do that because the fear has been projected upon them. And you can, like I said, you can motivate anybody to do anything. And the other thing is when a mammal is fearful, when a human female or any other mammal is fearful, then labor is most often dysfunctional.
Yeah.
And then, so the interventions that they say they have to do are more likely to be necessary.
Yeah.
So and the system profits from it.
Yeah.
And yeah, even in a system where you have government-run healthcare, the hospitals still get paid. The doctors still get paid. And so it's coming out of your tax money. And they don't cut them off. The more they do, the more they bill the government for, the more money they get paid.
Yeah.
And in my country, there's something really obscene going on. And that's a lot of physicians who work for major corporations as employees, their next year's salary is based on their production this year. So if they do more tests, if they do more C-sections, whatever their billing amounts to, that
projects their income for the next year.
Yeah. And whether that's, you know, a true motivation, it doesn't matter. The appearance of the conflict of interest is enough to shake anybody's confidence in the way the system is run. The key is ignorance because nobody knows that this stuff is going on. So we're pointing it out and you're pointing it out, and you know, all the other great people out there advocating for women to make their own decisions and be educated, and then for us to honor our ethical obligation to support informed decision-making and choice. Once we do that and women start challenging the medical system and start making some of those practitioners uncomfortable, instead of just saying, here's a bottle of sweet stuff, drink it, and I'll see you in 2 weeks. Mm. Asking them, okay, so what's behind, why? This is not how I eat. Why are you making me do this? Mm. What does the number really mean? If I'm 139, I'm okay. But if I'm 140, I'm diabetic. Does that really make sense? I mean, ask these questions. But the problem is we don't know the questions to ask.
I know, but it's such a tricky thing. I see so many mums, you know, look, I'm not good with all those numbers. You know, I had a mum recently who got 5.1 on the diabetes test, you know, and the seed of doubt was there. And she's calling me from the hospital saying, I know I don't need to be induced, but I just feel too anxious now to go home and go into labor. So I'm here and I'm having the Prostin gel. And, you know, it was just so, the baby was fine, great size, like it was all good. But yeah.
Yeah, it is all good. Yeah, I don't know how, once you get into that hamster wheel, it's hard to get out.
Yeah.
So the key is to not get in it in the first place. And the best way to avoid being anxious and being cornered into doing things is to have knowledge. And I can tell you that nothing we say today applies to all OBs or all hospitals or all midwives. That's a given. But when you have the knowledge, you have the ability to say to somebody, you know what, you're full of shit, and I'm going to find a new practitioner because you're not making me feel good. All you do every time I come in here is scare me.
Yeah.
And why do you do that? I think you do it because you're scared.
And now for a quick break. At She Births, we believe that pregnancy, birth, and matrescence, the sacred postpartum, is an awesome rite of passage. Our free holistic pregnancy guide offers you 6 months of weekly support. Drop straight into your inbox or within our free She Births app, you can get content that will nourish your body, mind, and soul. You can enjoy prenatal yoga videos, great recipes, birth affirmations, course discounts, and more. From me and my team, the creator of the world's only scientifically verified antenatal classes, it is our gift to you. Sign up today and receive the free holistic pregnancy guide at shebirths.com/PG. That's shebirths.com/PG.
And I will tell you that, you know, we hear a lot of stories about bullying in the hospital, and we hear a lot of stories about people being mean and people being impatient with you. And this is just a very simple thing about human nature. People that love their work and people that are happy don't bully other people. They aren't mean to other people. They're not rushed. They give you the time, or they have a polite way of saying to you, you know, I can't do this today because I've got a full schedule, but you know what? I'll call you after work or something. And they treat people with the dignity that they deserve, the whole basic golden rule. And when you don't see that constantly in a hospital setting, it's because everyone there is under pressure.
That's right. Well, the power over system is just kind of, and they're in a state of fear of losing their positions and behaving a particular way and doing certain protocols. And there's a power over and there's a bullying coming, trickling down.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So give us some examples of, you know, what led you to where you are now. I'm sure, was it a long process? Was it like an overnight epiphany? Like, did you just start attending home births? What happened?
Well, I'll try to make it a briefer. I have a long version of this, but I'll try to make it brief. I never thought about being a doctor until I was in my third year of college. I went to college after high school in the United States because that's what everybody did. This was in the late 70s, so I'm dating myself. The world was different back then. And I decided to go to medical school because some of my buddies were, and it made my mom happy. So I decided to go to medical school, and I got into medical school at the University of Minnesota. And I went there for 4 years. And in the third year, first 2 years are mostly didactic classroom stuff and laboratory stuff and anatomy class and stuff. And the second 2 years are almost all rotations where you go off on, you know, neurology and internal medicine and pediatrics and ear, nose, and throat and whatever. And I had just come off hematology oncology, which I sort of found quite depressing. And my next rotation happened to be OBGYN. And I still remember this. And of course, these are composite memories, obviously. But I remember this specifically, being up the first night I was on call and catching little baby Christopher Smith from his mom, Debbie Smith, who was 18 years old, single mom, at St. Joseph's Hospital in St. Paul, Minnesota. And so I was up at 3 a.m. catching a baby rather than pushing chemotherapy or doing something more depressing than that. And I thought, wow, this is really cool. And then I started to think more about the profession and realized that one of the things I really liked about it was that it had longitudinal care. Longitudinal care is taking care of people over their entire lifetime or most of their lifetime. And there's only three main specialties that do that, and it's family practice, internal medicine, and OBGYN. Pediatricians have it for a short period of time with children, but they're really relating to their parents over that time. So there was those four. But the other thing that OB had to offer for me was I like surgery. Internal medicine, family practice, you really don't do much of surgery at all. I liked the fact that we had a little bit of psychiatry, a little bit of endocrinology, some internal medicine, that sort of thing. So we had a little bit of everything. Plus, our patients were young, generally got better. You know, internal medicine, you're tinkering a lot with hypertension and diabetes and cancer, and, you know, eventually your patients will die. And we don't, you know, in OB, you don't really have that. You have young people who are really kind of coming in generally happy to see you.
Yeah.
Because they're coming in. I always knew they were coming in because they're not sick.
Yes. They're not really patients, right? They're clients.
But my profession looks at it as pregnancy as an illness. I sort of never did that. Until residency changed me for a while, but it also opened the door for me to be more open to things. So I matched my residency in Southern California, and I came out of residency very well trained, and partly because my program had a relationship with LA County USC, which is Los Angeles County University of Southern California Women's Hospital, which in the early 80s was the busiest hospital in the United States. They were doing about 22,000 births a year. So people can compare that to their local hospital. Comes out to be about 65 babies a day.
Wow.
And we're on every other day for 4 months. So that's about 60 days we're on, seeing 60 some births a day. Now, obviously each resident doesn't see all 60 births. But when you're seeing 65 births a day, you're seeing at least two or three breaches a day.
Wow.
You're seeing at least two or three sets of twins a day. So you get used to that sort of thing. And we found out that those things seemed just to be normal for us. We never considered them to be a problem. They were just a variation of normal. And as a matter of fact, we used to fight over who would get the breech mama in labor because we all wanted it.
More interesting, right?
It was more interesting, right. So then I came out of residency very, very well trained in the medical birth model. I came out very well trained, but very medicalized. And I did things back then that I sort of look back on now, and some of the things that I tend to mock now. And I've talked about this many times. I mean, I was the doctor in the full hazmat suit with you in lithotomy position, with covering your legs with sterile drapes and wiping off your bottom with betadine and catching the baby and immediately cutting the cord and showing you this beautiful thing that you just created. And then your arms are out to look at your baby and I'm walking the baby across the room and setting it down in the warmer. This is what we were trained to do. In medical school, we cut episiotomies on every woman, even if it was her fourth baby. She got an episiotomy. This is just what we were trained to do. And when you're trained to do something, you become that, you think that that's the way to do it. And so most of us got indoctrinated to that way and never change. And most of my colleagues who've been practicing 10, 20, 30 years, they still practice the same way that they were taught. They don't do a lot of continuing education on learning techniques and stuff. They're intelligent, they're reading stuff, but they're not changing the way they do things. And if they wanted to change them, sometimes they can't because the hospital system won't let them. But I had the good fortune of coming out and being approached by some local midwives to take their home birth transports. And this was the beginning of the whole evolution for me. You asked if it was an epiphany or anything like that. Absolutely not. It was not. I took their transports because I wanted to make money, not because I thought midwifery was a good idea, and certainly not because I thought home birth was a good idea. I was just as sort of turned off to that as any doctor coming out of training who's been told over and over again that home birth is dangerous. But I began to see a different way of doing things. I began to see that the clients that came in were not sick. They were not stupid. They were not foolish. They just needed some pain relief. And then they ended up usually having vaginal deliveries. But we had a lot of time once they came in and got their epidural and then maybe needed Pitocin to sit around and talk to the midwives. And I began to learn a different way of doing things. And slowly but surely over the next 10 years, I got enough confidence to form a collaborative midwifery practice with two certified nurse midwives at a hospital north of Los Angeles because Cedars-Sinai at that time did not allow midwives to have privileges. And for 15 years, we had a really good thing going on. but we were never accepted in the community. The community didn't like us because we did things differently. And we were the nail that stands out. And the old Japanese proverb about what do you do with the nail that stands out? You pound it back in again. And they never made it easy for us. Even though our numbers were great, we had great patient satisfaction. We had really good outcomes compared to the other doctors in the same facility. Our C-section rate was 7%. We took all comers. The midwives took care of the normal stuff like they're supposed to. The well woman exams, the birth control, the normal labors. And I took care of somebody that needed a colposcopy or needed a surgery for an ectopic pregnancy or had breaches or twins. I did those. And we had really good statistics. But eventually what happened is that the nurses and the anesthesia department and the pediatric department were not happy. We made them nervous. Mm. And so they decided they weren't going to renew our privileges. They banned the midwives. They banned VBAC. They banned breach delivery. And then they were not going to renew my privileges. And so I had a choice of fighting them or going off and doing home birthing. And fortunately, by that point, I had become very well, I had high regard for the midwives in the Los Angeles community. And a lot of them were my friends. And they basically advised me to start doing home births. And even after 25 years of backing midwives, I had never been to a home birth. And I went to the first one and it was beautiful. And slowly but surely, I started to get bolder over the next decade and began to do things like breaches and twins and diabetics and hypertensives at home because I started to ask myself that stage two question of why not? Why can't I do these at home? Mm. Why do all diabetics need to be in the hospital? Mm. So that was the short, long version of the long, long version of how I got to where I'm doing now, what I'm doing now.
Thank you for sharing. I wonder if the sort of underlying thread is not just this fear around the body and around birth, but also like under that model where, 80 to 90% of women are really under the primary care of the midwife and an obstetrician kind of is in the background. We probably need a lot less obstetricians, or is it just the different operating? I mean, what is the big threat to allowing midwives to truly care for women? I mean, the way you guys have it in America is so stuffed. Like, it's just crazy.
Yeah, you want to say stupid? You can call it stupid. It is.
I was thinking something stronger, but I want to say it.
Doctors are experts in high-risk birthing. And they don't know squat, really, about doing nothing. We have no training in doing nothing. And about 80% of women don't need anything done to them. They just need to be left alone when they're in labor. Midwives are the experts in normal birthing. And so midwives should be taking care of most women in our country, in your country. And doctors should step in when that's necessary. It's a very easy thing to do. The problem is that it's always about the money. And if that were true, we would need to fire a lot of doctors and we would need to train a lot of midwives, but not midwives trained in a medicalized model, because otherwise you're just changing the title of the same sort of treatment that women are going to get. Yeah. But you would need to do that. It would be great. Ideally, most women should be cared for by midwives in collaboration with physicians when necessary.
Yeah.
But physicians should keep their noses out of most of obstetrics. And I think what's really happened is the explosion of maternal fetal medicine doctors, because they need to keep feeding themselves. And so they are what I would consider a major propagator of fear. Granted, yes, sometimes they're right. But
so
funnily,
the continuous kind of ultrasounding and analysis of data and let's continue monitoring in case XYZ.
Right, because every there's no money in them doing nothing. So if they see a woman and find that everything's perfect, to tell them not to come back doesn't make as much money as telling them, well, everything looks perfect, but there was this one little dilated kidney and I want to see it again in 6 weeks. And so then the woman says to herself when she goes home, he said my baby was normal, but the kidney has a little dilation in it. So what's she thinking about for 6 weeks? There's something wrong with my baby's kidney.
Yeah.
And so there's no consideration given for the fact that what is that stress on the mother doing to the developing baby? It's not even a consideration. And maternal fetal medicine doctors, they're trained in high risk obstetrics. So they see everything as high risk. If you're a hammer, everything is a nail. And this is how they see things. And how do I know that? Because I have a unique position of having lived in both worlds for quite a long time. And I'm a great observer of things, and my brain can't shut off sometimes, and I overanalyze. But I see the misuse of technology, and the idea that all twins need to be scanned this often. Mm. Like every twin is on an algorithm. There's no individuality between mothers and twins, and very little preventative care is done. Mm. How do we prevent preeclampsia? How do we prevent diabetes? No, we know how to treat it.
Nutrition and the understanding of magnesium and like, oh man, there's so much to do in preventative methods that just don't get discussed at all.
But the medical model doesn't really allow doctors to do that because doctors have about 6 to 7 minutes for a prenatal visit.
Yeah.
So, you know, I do feel like a broken record because I talk about this a lot on my podcast and other podcasts and when I'm at my breach seminars. But you can never repeat it enough.
Yeah.
Because always you're going to get a new audience and they're going to hear this and they're going to, you know, they may say that, well, that just doesn't sound right. It just sounds really like mean and degrading. I'm not. I'm trying to be very truthful. This is how they look at birth. All that matters in the medical model, this is a slogan that of mine, is a live baby in the bassinet. And that's how maternal, once the baby's in the bassinet, their job is over. What happens to that baby? What happens to that mother afterwards? What happens to that mother's future babies is not their concern. And if that sounds harsh, just take a step back and think about it for a second. Why would they act the way they act? Why would everyone have to have all these things done to them? Why can't we individualize care? I mean, you go to a restaurant and you're allowed to order different things or not order anything if you don't want. But when you go to the doctor's office, you're not in charge of anything. They're telling you, here's what we're going to do next visit. And if you stop to say why, they may answer you or they may roll their eyes or they may give you some kind of bullshit answer. Well, that's just what we do.
Yeah.
It reminds me of the little kid who's a little annoying to his parents. And after a while, he keeps saying why. And after his parents just say, because I said so. And that's not an answer. And either is, well, this is our hospital policy.
Yeah.
That's not an answer. That's a non sequitur. It's a non-responsive response, if you can quote a legal term. It's unresponsive. You're not answering the question. You're saying, well, here's why we have to do something. Well, but why are we doing, why is the hospital doing it? Mm. Why do they have a policy against eating?
During labor, I mean, it's the dumbest
right.
thing in the world.
I mean, things are changing, but they're changing randomly. I mean, I want to come out with a very positive thing. I've heard some very good stories lately about isolated hospital here, isolated hospital in this country or that country. Yeah. But most of the time, you're not hearing those stories because you wouldn't have, what was your C-section rate again?
Unfortunately, at the Royal Hospital, Randwick in Sydney, that does 4,500 births a year, last month, the C-section rate was 44%.
Yeah, you can't be doing things right if you have a C-section rate of 44%. Just can't.
No, and I remember when it was 25%, you know, 20 years ago. And
50 years ago, it was 5%. 50 years ago, it was 5%.
Yeah. And
if we had better outcomes, Nadine, you could argue. I mean, again, I would still argue against it because I think surgical birth has lots of other problems for mom and baby and mom's future babies. But if at least they were having better outcomes, that would be one thing. But the outcomes aren't better.
No, our mortality, morbidity rates have not improved, not with all the inductions and all the seizures. They haven't improved. I mean, and I suppose that's something to maybe mention. I always just get so afraid that we're heading towards America. And I see third world countries heading towards America too. You know, I go to ashrams in India and they have these gorgeous hospitals that the gurus just funded through the charity. And look at all these nurses being trained. And the C-section rate's like 50 to 60% in a village in India. And you're like, that's insane. And everyone's celebrating this wonderful hospital saving lives and looking after mums and babies and employing all these people and training. But like, it's not okay. I mean, it's just moving towards Brazil and then you've got what we have in America, which is horrific. Your mortality, morbidity rates, and your healthcare system, and the racism. There's a lot of things in playing out. But, you know, I'm so afraid that these non-developed countries and these uneducated women, they're just moving so rapidly towards high intervention that we're going to forget birth. You know, as Michelle O'Donnell says, like, are we going to forget love too by not allowing oxytocin? It's a compounding of many issues.
Yeah, and it just seems like the people leading us are just leading us right over a cliff. And, you know, again, as I say, the system works well for them because they're in power. They make good salaries. They feel important. And so they have almost no self-awareness.
Yeah.
Of the fact that their outcomes are terrible. That these things don't make sense. I mean, I don't think anybody who's listening to you is a big fan of the World Health Organization, but they come out and say in Western countries, the C-section rate should be somewhere between 10 and 15%.
Yeah.
And in your country, it's three times that.
Yeah.
Or at least in Sydney at that hospital.
Yeah.
So if you believe then that's correct, and if you take a longer time period than 1 month, but if you believe that, that means that 50% or more of all your C-sections being done are unnecessary.
Yeah.
And nobody's saying anything about that. They were doing unnecessary surgery for knees or gallbladders or mastectomies or whatever, people would be outraged. And your government agencies that pay for those things would be outraged. And there would be investigations. Of course, investigations never lead anywhere anyway. You know, that's a fool's errand. But there would be an outcry.
Yeah.
But yet hundreds of thousands in my country, over a million women every year, almost a million women every year, not quite a million, about 750,000 women every year are having unnecessary surgery.
Mm.
And no one says anything.
Yeah.
And, you know, and what long-term consequences come from that?
Yeah.
You know, when women have
physical,
right? Yeah,
internal for the mother and the baby and so many.
We from the grassroots have to say no. We have to start saying no.
Yeah.
It's not going to correct itself from above. You're not going to get a government agency or a hospital administrator to say, we're going to shoot for a 12% C-section rate. And we're going to have a Breach Without Borders come in and teach breach to our thing. And we're going to do breach delivery. And we're going to support VBAC, and we're not going to have a timetable, and we're going to let people labor as long as they want. As a matter of fact, we're going to tell people when they rupture their membranes to stay home. We're going to, you know, we're going to tell people that are early labor to stay home. Don't come in yet. If you get to 40 weeks, say, okay, good. I'll see you next week for your prenatal visit. Don't say, oh, you're 40 weeks. Let's schedule your induction. And mm-hmm. By the way, we're not going to scare women who happen to be over 35 because it doesn't mean anything. It's a stupid number. It doesn't mean anything. And yet every woman in the world, not in the world, but every woman in Western country, the minute they reach 35, they've heard enough about it to think that now they're high risk simply because they're 35. So the indoctrination from the fear-based model has done its job.
Yeah.
Because now they believe that there's a problem. I get emails and consults all the time. And the first thing they say to me, Hi, Dr. Stu. I just want to let you know that I'm pregnant for the first time and I'm over 35. It's like, so they already think of it as a problem. Yeah. I would never even ask the question. It's not even relevant. It might be relevant for genetic testing and stuff. But otherwise than that, once that's over, then you treat them like any other pregnant woman. Because even though their risks of certain things might be increased, it's almost a statistical ditzel that how much it's increased. And then you just watch for them. And if they develop preeclampsia, okay, fine. Then you'll deal with it.
Yeah,
but to scare them at 12 weeks and say you're more likely to develop hypertension or diabetes or growth restriction or have a stillbirth or anything at 12 weeks, what are you doing to that woman's brain for 12 weeks? I mean, excuse me, for the 28 weeks that are remaining.
There's a lot of stuff there.
we have to say these things because it's important that the women who are listening understand this so that they can start to take their autonomy back and realize that your body was made to do this. And Yeah. It's nature's design or God's design, whichever way you want to go, is really perfect. Yeah. Does it always come out perfect? No. But it is a miracle. When you think about the fact that a sperm with 23 chromosomes joins an egg with 23 chromosomes and forms one cell with 46 chromosomes, and that cell begins to divide. And some of those cells will become placenta, and some of those cells will become baby. And how do they know? Who told them? You know, and then when they start to divide into baby, some will become liver and some will become middle ear and some will become fingernail and some will become, you know, kneecap. And how do they know? And how do they know to go to the right place? You know, it's amazing. Yeah. It's a miracle.
Intelligence of nature.
And nature's design for birth is meant to help the species survive.
Yeah.
A mammal, when it's ready to give birth, will go off by itself to a quiet place. It would not get in a car and drive to the stockyards where all the other cows are to give birth. It wouldn't do that. It goes off by itself. And the other animals protect the reverence of the situation.
Yeah.
They give it space. And if the mammal is uncomfortable, the mammal moves. And if she's hungry, she eats or drinks. You would never take away the food and water from your dog in labor. You would never do that. You would never strap your dog down.
No.
You wouldn't do those things. And you would tell the little kids to do what? Leave the dog alone.
Yeah.
Right.
You'd
honor the space. But for the human female, we do almost everything we do is antithetical to that. And we have to ask ourselves, how did we get here? How do we get from the granny midwives and stuff? Yeah, I mean, we didn't know germ theory and women died of sepsis and there was problems with infections. And then, yeah, we got there. But 1970, we had dealt with all that and we had a 5% C-section rate.
Yeah, right.
And the rate of cerebral palsy has not dropped despite the cesarean section rate going up 500, 600, 700%. So why don't these people recognize that are running our medical schools and our residency programs and our hospitals? Why don't they? Because nobody's pushing them. And the push isn't going to come from government because the government is bought off by whoever pays the lobbyist. This is a very depressing.
I know.
But it has to come. So that's why it has to come from the grassroots.
I know. And this is, I suppose, where it's kind of so heartbreaking. And, you know, as birth educators and like doulas, we are grassroots, right? 100% and what you do. And we just try and impact as many people as we can and meet them where they're at and help appease their fears through knowledge, all these steps. But man, it is absolutely exhausting for a lot of our mums, you know, trying to be that person that says, no, I deserve individualized care. Like I'm not coming in for an induction. And, or to do the sneaky thing and say, well, actually I'm in pre-labor. I'll come in maybe probably tonight, you know, or actually, I mean, we suggest, can we come in and get scans and heart rate monitoring, you know, tomorrow or today so that you're happy and will let me go. And also will let me, this kind of battling and this educating from the bottom up it can be really taxing at a time when we really just need to be letting go of our neocortex and just completely relaxing.
Yeah, I don't want people to be as sort of type A as I am and OCD, but what I would tell young women is don't wait until you're pregnant to try to find a caregiver that you like.
Oh,
because you want the pregnancy to be as stress-free as possible. So yeah. do your research before you even consider getting pregnant if you can. Doesn't always work that way. But before, you know, if you can, start to research your community, your neighborhood, your locality. Find out, you know, talk to the local doulas, talk to the local labor and delivery nurses. Ask them who, you know, if you want a hospital birth, ask them, like, who would you go to if you were pregnant? Because labor and delivery nurses love gossiping. They do. They love commenting and they love being asked, like, who are the good doctors and who are the bad doctors? And then, you know, and get several opinions and plan ahead and put money aside when you're young. In a savings account of some kind, so that if you just get pregnant and if everything that's offered to you under your government thing or something isn't what you want, that you can afford to then go elsewhere, go outside, go to the private sector. It's not always better, but try to find somebody in the private sector or have a home birth with a, you know, with a licensed midwife or a certified professional midwife, whatever you call them in Australia. But plan ahead. Don't let those money or lack of planning dictate what you end up doing for this, probably one of the most important events of your life.
Yeah.
You need to plan ahead for these sorts of things. It's kind of like a college fund as a parent. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a lot of parents don't do it. And then their kids have they take out loans and then they're saddled with, in my country, I don't know how it works in Australia, but in my country, a lot of kids go get a 4-year degree, which is worth nothing. And they owe $100,000. And so they're going to be in debt forever. But if they were to start put money away, the parents did when they were on the baby's first birthday, by the age 18, they might have a nice little nest egg in there.
Mm.
I think we call them 529 plans or 429 plans in the United States. And I had one for my daughter. And so my daughter's college was paid for by money that I had saved over the years since she was like 2 years old.
Yeah.
So plan for their birth, just like you would plan for anything else. Mm-hmm. Plan ahead. Don't wait until you find out that you're breech at 37 weeks to find out that the person you've been seeing doesn't think breech is safe and doesn't do breech.
Yeah.
Ask these questions early on. There's no way to save everyone. Everyone has to save themselves. We really do. That you have to take responsibility for this because the system is broken. And you're not going to get what you want from the system. You sometimes will. And sometimes they're life-saving and they do wonderful miracle things. But most of women don't need that.
Mm.
What they need is really just support and to be left alone and be able to catch their own baby and leave the cord alone and not have the baby get any injections and not have the cord severed for until it's done pulsating or the placenta's delivered. And go home right away. Don't spend 2 days in the hospital postpartum. Find a postpartum doula or a family member or something to come and support you and build up a sense of community again.
Mm.
It's really important.
And now for a quick break. Contrary to popular culture, She Births believes that childbirth can be the best day of your life. It is designed perfectly to be empowering, enriching, and bonding. An awesome rite of passage. Our childbirth education programs have helped thousands of families around the world since 2008, allowing families to not only feel empowered through education, but also connect with their innate birthing wisdom to create the best birth possible and begin their parenting journey with confidence. She Births' unique methodology was scrutinized in university trials and has been published in the British Medical Journal for improving birth outcomes for both mother and child. I'd like to invite you to begin preparing for birth today. Just go to shebirths.com to discover our 2-day weekend face-to-face courses or access the online courses from anywhere around the world. That's shebirths.com. Create your beautiful birth with the world's only scientifically verified antenatal classes.
I have a lot of families in California that really don't want to follow the CDC's vaccine schedule. They don't want to vaccinate their kids. But in California and other states, you can't go to school.
Yeah.
You can't go to public school without having all these vaccines in you. So I talk about, well, why don't you consider home birthing? Like, oh, I can't do that. Well, I said, there's communities online. You can find a whole bunch of families. Get 10 families together who are like-minded. And then you could even hire a teacher.
Yeah.
And you'd have a 10-to-1 ratio.
Yeah.
With a teacher that you have control over what the curriculum is to teach your children.
Yeah.
I mean, you can, there are innovative ways to do these sorts of things. But it is daunting sometimes. And so people just are more passive until they complain
until
later on.
Until the trauma happens.
Yes.
I think when the trauma happens, I get really upset that people really blame it on birth, that continuation of the narrative. But yeah, I think I'm writing my book and hope to explain that so much of the trauma is really being perpetuated by this externalized authority and faith in system that really isn't deserving. And so you said that thing. I mean, I know you've probably got to go. We've had you a long time.
No. I'll stay as long as you want. So you don't have any. Thanks. I have another meeting in an hour and 5 minutes. So I'm happy to stay as long as you want. Because we really haven't talked about any of the other topics that you really wanted to talk about.
We've talked about lots of things, but it's like this idea that the system is broken. I'm really interested in, well, is the system broken or is it actually just working the way it was crafted originally to work? Is that what's really going on? Like, I don't know enough. I don't have enough time to bloody look into the history of all of these things, but the things I've heard about the sort of marketing campaigns against midwives and then this sort of, I don't know, with the family, the Rothschilds or whoever it was that created medical systems, like we're so far away from the Hippocratic Oath. Like, I don't understand. Is the system designed this way, the healthcare system?
Yeah, you nailed it on the head. And I sort of said something, but not as eloquently as you did earlier. I said that the system is broken except for the people running it.
Yeah, right.
Because the people running it are very happy with the way it's being run. So is this is it purposeful this way? Yes, it is. Yeah. It generates revenue.
Yeah.
You know, it's an interesting thing. No one ever looks at the root cause. I just did a deep dive for our Patreon group on Zurzuvae. Zurzuvae is a new medication by Sage Pharmaceutical Company for postpartum depression.
Wow.
And their selling point goes, you know, 30-some% of women have postpartum depression. And this is a new medication that only take for 14 days and it seems to work and blah, blah, blah. And of course, it's got all these side effects, just like you hear in a television commercial for drugs, where it's all the...
Thank God we don't have those yet.
Oh my God. Yeah. They're actually quite humorous. They have the old couple walking on the beach and having a good time. And then for 20 seconds, they talk about bloody diarrhea and eczema and skin rashes and your eyeballs falling out. And then they show the couple walking on the beach again for 10 seconds. And that's a commercial for a drug in America. but I did a deep dive on this medication. And the point I'm making about it is that if we have a 35 or 40% postpartum depression rate, and they're not talking about baby blues here, they're talking about true postpartum depression. I don't know it's that high. It may very well be, because I'm not an expert in that. But their solution for that is not to figure out why that's happening.
Mm.
They don't want to know why it's happening. Because if they figure out why it's happening, we prevent why it's happening, they can't sell any more Zurzuvae.
Yeah.
So the point is, with all these things, it's the treatment. It's like my internist wanted to put me on a statin a decade ago. And I said no, and I decided, but he never asked me about what I eat. He never asked me about how tired I am being up all night so often when I was on call in those days and being stressed out about that. He never talked to me about stress reduction or exercise. I mean, he talked about exercise. I don't want to give him no credit, but he didn't say, let's try these things for a couple months and then you come back and we'll see what you're doing. Nor did he explain to me the value of cholesterol in helping your brain remyelinate and do things. None of those things were talked to me. And so everybody's on a statin because you can make money on a statin. My doctor doesn't make any money on a statin, but the pharmaceutical companies make a fortune on it. So it's just more expeditious for my doctor to write a prescription for statins than to spend a lot of time with me talking about how to be healthier. And so the pharmaceutical company, everything is by design. It's very sinister to think that way, and it's almost like too bright to look at. They say that evil is dark, but evil isn't dark. Evil is really bright, and you can't look at it. And this is staring you right in the face through history of the malfeasance of big medicine and big pharma from the time of, you know, the turn of the 19th century when we started talking about all the use of heavy metals on things. And all of a sudden, diseases that never existed before are starting to exist.
What do you mean? What was that? What was the heavy metals on things? What do you mean?
Oh, well, there's a book called The Moth in the Iron Lung, which talks about the polio epidemic.
Yeah.
And people thought that polio was came from the poliomyelitis came from the polio virus. But actually what turns out, it's only a very small number of poliomyelitis cases come from the polio virus. And it may not be the polio virus that causes the inflammation in and of itself. It may be the fact that in those days they were using pesticides that contained arsenic.
Right. Yeah.
And lead and other toxic substances. And mercury was used as a medication. They had a teething powder for babies called with mercury in it. And even in the 50s and 60s, when I was a little kid, if I got a cut on my leg, my mom put mercurochrome on it.
Wow.
Now I'll tell you, that really killed the bacteria, but why did it kill the bacteria? Because it had mercury in it.
Yeah.
Right. Whoever started, they wanted people to be sick. They were in petroleum. I mean, a lot of these products come from petroleum.
Wow.
They created the American Medical Association or something like it. And they took over the medicine from individual practitioners and granny midwives and other people that were practicing medicine, and they made it a medical thing, and they made it an industrial complex, and it feeds on itself. So your premise of, is it working the way they want to, or does it? Yes, it is working the way they want it to. The problem is it doesn't work for the advantage of the men and women and children that we're supposed to be caring for. Mm-hmm. And that's just obvious by the results.
Mm.
I mean, right now, 54% of children in my country are labeled as having a chronic illness or an autoimmune disorder.
Oh my God. Now,
think about that. Now with the advent of COVID onto the vaccine schedule in my country, by the way, which COVID for vaccines for children is almost as bad, is probably worse than hepatitis vaccine for a newborn. It's stupid. Children don't die from COVID. They barely get sick. And the vaccine doesn't prevent transmission or infection anyway. And now you're going to give 18 added shots to the schedule. So now there are 90 shots that a child gets from age 0 to 18 in the United States on the CDC schedule. And pretty soon they'll be adding RSV. So they'll be probably up to 108 shots, or, you know, maybe not that many, but they'll, you know, you'll be over 90 shots. When I was a kid, I think I got one. And I think I had oral polio vaccine. Mm-hmm. And I think I got tetanus shots.
Yeah.
Once you start seeing this, you can't take these people seriously. And it's very difficult because we want to. The world is crazy enough to now think that you have one more thing that you can't trust. But you can't.
Yeah.
That's why women who are pregnant and their husbands who want to protect them need to do this research ahead of time. They need to look into it because there are ways to have the birth that you want. I mean, there are glorious stories on our threads on Facebook and Instagram and stuff like that. We hear beautiful stories.
Yeah.
You know, there are tragedies, but that's always the case in birthing.
Yeah.
There's always going to be tragedies, but you know, per capita, they happen more often in the hospital. Most likely, again, because of the way they treated you.
Yeah.
There are a lot of babies that walk into the hospital inside their mothers at 40 weeks, 41 weeks, 39 weeks, who are perfectly healthy, who 2 days later, after a 2-day induction, end up, they're in the NICU. And they say, wow, thank God you were in the hospital, because what would have happened if you'd had this baby at home?
Yeah.
Well, I might've had this baby at home a week later and it would have been in my arms and being just fine. But because you brought me in to induce me and did this whole cascade of interventions, and now my baby's in the NICU and I'm supposed to be grateful?
Mm.
What are you, out of your freaking mind?
Well, can we quickly break that down? The whole, like, I've listened to your podcast with Bliss, really breaking down that the earlier ultrasound is a way better kind of guide to actual sort of gestational age. And I'm getting confused with language here, but the overdue thing. Why are so many mums being induced now? Why have we not moved away from the ARRIVE trial? Why is it still happening more and more? Because it's doubled in 20 years in our local hospitals here. And I mean, the ARRIVE trial has been disputed and has been broken down by so many respectable people. And yet, why does the term breach trial, why does the ARRIVE trial still get implemented?
It's called confirmation bias. It's because that's what the medical model wanted to see happen. It's almost as if, well, I'll tell you about the ARRIVE trial. It's really interesting. 2 years before the ARRIVE trial came out, there was a ACOG meeting. I think it was in the East Coast. And I think I was watching virtually, because I don't remember actually being there. But I was watching virtually, and two guys Dr. Lockwood and Dr. Norwich, two heads of their departments on East Coast medical schools, were going to debate the idea that 39 weeks was a good idea to induce, and one was going to say that it wasn't a good idea to induce. But actually what it turned out in a debate, as you know, it should be two people who have opposing views.
Yeah. Well,
it was a setup, because both doctors in the end agreed that, you know, they both came around agreeing that 39 weeks was a good time to induce. And what's really scary is before the debate, they took a poll of the audience, and the audience had those little buttons they can push. And they said, how many of you think it's a good idea to induce at 39 weeks? I think it was about 24% that said yes. At the end of the debate, it was close to 70% that said yes.
Wow.
So all it took was an hour of two guys pretending that one of them had a different viewpoint to convince these obstetricians that are very, you know, they're very medicalized people that go to the ACOG meetings, that this was a good idea. And sure enough, 2 years later, a paper comes out that says it's a good idea, despite the fact there were a lot of papers that came out that said inducing unfavorable cervixes in a primip, you know, is not, you know, it's going to lead to more problems, more intervention. They ignored those ones, just like the term breech trial. There were many papers that came out that said vaginal breech birth is as safe as cesarean for breech birth. And they ignored those too, because that's what the medical community, whoever they are, wanted to see happen. Mm-hmm. But it was so fascinating to me to see it play out like that. Like, yeah. 2 years earlier, these guys were laying the groundwork and preparing you for this paper that was going to come out and tell you exactly what they wanted you to hear. So it doesn't make any sense. Having, you know, the due date of 40 weeks is based on a last menstrual period.
Yeah.
It's accurate for most women, but there's a certain percentage of women who are having irregular periods or are still postpartum and are nursing and aren't having periods yet or whatever. And for those women, having an early ultrasound to determine their gestational age, because a lot of tests and things are based on your gestational age and that kind of thing. But the idea that 40 weeks is like, oh my God, you go past 40 weeks and you're in trouble, is really, again, it's a stupid analysis by doctors who don't think out of their box. Because the truth is that 40 weeks is the peak of a bell-shaped curve. Mm-hmm. What is a bell-shaped curve? It means that half of people are before that time and half of people are after that time.
Yeah.
More or less. So that means that you're saying that if you go past 40 weeks, that's abnormal. Then you're saying about 46% of women are abnormal. And that's ridiculous.
Mm.
They set these numbers up in order to get people to do what they want to do. Look at, they've changed the definition 6 times of growth restriction. And currently, the maternal fetal medicine doctors that I seem to be reading their reports consider a baby less than the 10th percentile to be growth restricted, which is not my definition of growth restriction. My definition of growth restriction is a baby that's falling off of its growth curve. Mm. Because how many babies? How many babies need to be under the 10th percentile?
10%.
10%. So what are you saying? So they're saying that 10% of babies are growth restricted.
Yeah.
That's foolish. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, it used to be 3%, and that's something you could potentially believe. But by having it 10% now, what does that mean for their business?
Yeah.
More ultrasounds, more inductions, more revenue generating by changing definitions to get them to get women to believe that their baby is small. If a baby's at the 8th percentile, at 20 weeks, maybe your dates are off a little bit. So let's scan you again in a month and see. And so now at 24 weeks, your baby is 8th percentile. Is that baby growth restricted, or is that baby growing perfectly on its growth curve?
Yeah, it's on its
curve. The latter, but what will you be told?
Yeah.
Still, you'll be told, boy, your baby's on the small side.
Yeah.
Again, planting seeds, it's inception, except it's overt inception of planting these thoughts into your mind. And so now they're worried the entire pregnancy. And then that implies that, well, now we need to do more testing because your baby's growth restricted. And so they turn on the color flow Doppler. And the color flow Doppler carries with it higher non-ionizing radiation. And it's not indicated when a baby is growing normally. But that doesn't matter. My maternal fetal medicine friends read in their journals that you should do it all the time. Mm. And not only that, because there's a code you can bill for that. And the code is only gets paid when you have a diagnosis that matches the code. So you have to put down that they're growth restricted. It's very sinister. It's very sneaky.
I suppose, you know, it's so interesting. There's such a perpetuation of psychological damage and emotional damage that comes through the system. But I suppose, I mean, in myself trying to understand it and maybe to help others try and understand it without going into the us versus them, big bad guys kind of thing. I think we have to, you know, my therapist always reminds me, there's healed and there's unhealed. And when as a doula, you know, when I see really disgusting treatment sometimes of my mums, which I'm very good at like buffering and I'm so good at building rapport in order to manage the sort of gentle egoic manipulation of good treatment in some scenarios to make sure that that happens. You know, we've got so many little tools in our kit as doulas. That maltreatment, it's like the trauma begetting trauma. And then I also wonder those people like sitting in the OB sitting there going from 24 to 74% with like 39 weeks is okay to induce. Did they just not have the empathy or the awareness? Are they just the unhealed and the traumatized? I think something is happening in medical school training.
You know, when women go to the hospital, sometimes they're bullied. And sometimes they are, people are mean to them. And sometimes they will be cross or short with them, and they'll roll their eyes, or they'll won't treat them as a human being.
Yeah.
And you the thing that I would tell people is that happy people don't treat people that way.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
Did I say that already?
Yeah, but I think it's more than happiness. You know, I think there's a deep, deep indoctrination that's happening in the 12 years. You know.
Yeah, I know. I agree with that. But I'm also saying that.
Happy people.
Why would anyone want to live their life working a job where they're stressed out every day, 24/7?
Yeah.
Why would you want to do that? I mean, even midwives will take a break. But midwives have great relationships to at least fall back on with their clients.
Yeah.
These doctors tend to work a shift. There's often the nurses are understaffed.
Yeah.
They're watching things happen. If they know anything at all, they're watching things happen they know are wrong.
Yeah.
And they can't say anything about it. So you almost become, you know, if you have to have cognitive dissonance, or you almost become like a victim of Stockholm syndrome.
Well, that's right. And you go asleep, you just dissociate. You just dissociate and you stop being connecting to more and more humans. That's how it goes.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I've had a chance to talk to some residents this past year, and they all have a great enthusiasm. So,
yeah.
You know, I'm hoping that there's a change.
Mm.
And I'm hoping that the next generation doesn't have the same sort of cynicism and the same sort of ideals that again, because I don't think you can go into medicine right now with the idea that you're going to be running the ship, and so you end up with a different personality in there. But I do have hope. I do. I mean, despite everything that we've said.
Yeah,
I can see the movement growing.
Yes,
I can see the discomfort of the medical model growing. You know how I can see it? Because they're pushing back harder. Mm-hmm. And this is typically one of the death knells of an empire. I mean, you watch The Empire Strikes. You watch the Star Wars.
Yeah, we love it.
You know, while the rebellion was getting bigger and stronger, they didn't take it as a message that maybe we're doing something wrong. They pushed back harder, but eventually, you know, the force wins out. So I think it has to win out. I think the alternative is unthinkable, that we go down a path toward 80% C-section rates and babies who, like Michelle O'Donnell likes to say, that female babies who haven't been exposed to their mother's oxytocin may have trouble bonding, or may have trouble even having their uteruses contract properly in the future, because they maybe didn't develop oxytocin receptors. Nobody's doing the studies, by the way, Nadine. Nobody's looking at that.
No.
What we could easily do, that wouldn't be hard to do, but no one will do the study, is to look at children who were born to women who had no interventions whatsoever, either at home or in the hospital, to babies that were born by electively scheduled C-sections, and follow them for 20 years.
Yeah.
And try to make matched cohorts and see the health of those babies. see the mentality of those babies, see the IQ of those babies, and see if there's a difference. Mm-hmm. Because every time, again, this is a big point, every time you mess with Mother Nature, there are going to be consequences. And the importance of the important thing to remember is that it's not Mother Nature that has to prove she's right. Okay, it is the intervention that mm-hmm. has to prove, before you instill an intervention, you need to prove that that intervention actually does good and not harm.
Yeah.
And that's something that my colleagues don't think about.
Well, intervention should be forms of assistance, you know, that actually everybody has access to if needed. And yeah, in an individualized, caring way.
They're becoming more and more used when they didn't need to be used before. I mean, you look back at the big decisions in the 70s when they, or 60s and 70s, when they brought in continuous fetal monitoring and they followed the Friedman curve. Those two things, I think more than anything else, have led to the rising C-section rate. There's a lot of other factors, but those two things were implemented without anybody looking at them and saying, if we bring these in, because we think it might help prevent this problem or that problem or cerebral palsy or whatever, before we even study it, let's just make it universal. Nobody said to say, well, then, but what happens when we do that?
Yeah.
What's the downside? We're getting these fetal heart rate patterns. We don't really know what they mean.
Yeah.
So let's just section these moms.
Yeah.
And let's just assume that all women should dilate at the same rate.
Bad study.
Yeah. And in order to prove that they're dilating, they had to use vaginal exams to make points on the curve.
Yeah.
So what do multiple vaginal exams do to a woman in labor? Well, they do several things. First of all, they interrupt her. Second of all, it's uncomfortable. Third of all, they potentially increases the risk of infection. But they had to do it because you can't have a curve without points.
Yeah.
That's geometry. I remember that. So you needed vaginal exams. And those two things were implemented without anybody ever saying, you know, maybe it's not okay to think that all primates should dilate at the same rate. Yeah. And that anybody that's below the curve needs to have their labor sped up. Well, why? Do they ever watch labor?
No one does. That's the problem. No one's hanging out, you know? No one's
sitting
up 24 hours of their day and night to hang out and just be in the space and watch the unfolding and...
Because it's a business. It's a business. They have to move people in and out.
Yeah.
They can't let you labor there for 24 hours. Yet they'll induce somebody for 3 days, which is really I scratch my head to that. If you're in natural labor and you've been laboring for 18 hours and you're not finished yet, they might say, oh, you know, you're moving too slowly. We got to help you. But so we have to intervene on that. But then they have an induction that might go on for 3 days.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. That's a really good point. There's the $2,000 a day just being clocked up. Yeah, that's so true. But is that because you can code and bill it and like, I don't know.
I think that from the management point of view, yes, that's the case. I think from the individual doctor point of view, I think they think they're doing good.
Yeah, that's it.
They have to be thinking that, Nadine, because the alternative is to think that they know they're doing something that's wrong.
Yeah.
And I don't put that on my colleagues.
Yeah.
I put that on my colleagues that they're not flexible enough to look out for other options and to learn that there's a different way of doing something. But I don't think they're doing stuff for the most part because they want to hurt women.
Oh, they're just keeping their job and staying.
Yeah, but that's what the guards at Auschwitz said.
I know. They're just keeping their job and staying safe, you know? That's right. Exactly. But I think you make a really good point. And I think, yeah, you bring home so many truths, Stu. You're an absolute gift to the birthing world. So thank you.
Well, I thank you, Nadine. I feel good about the fact that I'm in a position now, which I never was in before, where I can speak freely. And a lot of people will disagree with me. And what I say will upsets a lot of people because they have personal trauma or whatever else, or they just disagree with me on principle. And again, I've offered many times to if there's a doctor out there, an OB out there who thinks that what I'm saying is dangerous, then let's have a live debate, not virtual, not messaging back and forth, but a live debate on a stage with an audience of 300 people with a moderator. And let's have a discussion about your way of doing obstetrics and why you think it's great and why you think what I and the midwives think is, you think it's bad. And I'll and we'll have my point of view as well. And we'll let the audience ask questions and we'll decide.
Yeah.
But they'll never do that. You never saw that during COVID. This is a big bugaboo. I mean, in my country, President Trump or President Biden could have taken Anthony Fauci and Deborah Birx, the two main characters pushing the whole lockdown stuff and the vaccine, on a stage with people like Peter McCullough and Jay Bhattacharya of the Great Barrington Declaration, and then had a moderator and had a debate so the American people and the people of the world could have seen the arguments.
Yeah,
have an informed. Those people in power won't ever do that. They won't do that.
Yeah.
Because they're really not secure in their position.
Mm.
Because people who are secure in their position don't mind being challenged.
Yeah. That's true.
Think about that. People should think about that.
Yeah, I think that's a lot. I think you've given us a lot to think about. But I'm going to stick with the Empire Strikes Back. And yeah. May the birthing empire and President Stu take us all the way.
Well, the Empire Strikes Back, the rebellion actually loses.
Oh, so
you got to go to the last one, which is I think the Return of the Jedi.
Okay, well there you go. We all need to return to being our own Jedis and taking care of ourselves and being sovereign martial artists and
Well, we're definitely either at the end of Empire Strikes Back or the beginning of the Return of the Jedi, because I sense awakening. I mean, I sense there's some marvelous people out there that are posting, and there's some great podcasts out there that people can listen to. And again, you can't absorb it all, but you can read and you can listen, and audiobooks is a great advancement for me because I can now listen to a book while I'm driving or while I'm out for a walk. I can't, you know, you couldn't read a book while you're out for a walk. I mean, I can't anyway. But you can learn these things, and really another thing to take a deep dive on is this vaccine issue. I'm not going to tell people what to do. If people ask me what I would do, I would tell them bluntly, and I think you know what I would tell them. But there's some great books out there, and you know, maybe in your show notes or whatever else, I can list some of the books that people can go look at. They can go to my website and find them, and I think it would be great for people to educate themselves and plan ahead for your birth. Don't be surprised.
I loved all those tips that you've given us and the alternative conversations, because people ask me as well. And I think that's going to be really helpful. Okay. One final question to you, because I forgot that the theme of this season, sometimes we have a theme, and this theme kind of uncovered itself because my friend's making this extraordinary film about intuition. They're doing this amazing intuition program with kids at the moment, and it's absolutely phenomenal. Like the results within 2 days, not even two full days, these kids can intuit what's on a card turned over there. They're using these kids in India to help the police find missing persons. Like the kids can intuit. And telling their parents, no, I'm going to this school, I'm not going to that school, mum. I know that school is better for me. And they can decipher if that person's going to be a good friend. Anyway, it's such a phenomenal intuition film that's coming in this program. Anywho, intuition is our theme. So is a mother's intuition real?
The film sounds really cool. And the answer is yes. They just don't trust it as much as they should.
Yeah.
Is it going to be wrong sometimes? Sure. We're all wrong sometimes, but more than anything else, what modern medicine needs to do is listen to the mother. The mother's going to tell you, how many stories do we hear where the mother's saying, I'm having a problem, or the baby's coming, and somebody's saying, no, it can't be, it can't happen. It's too early yet. The doctor's not here yet. It can't be coming, that sort of thing. Or during the pregnancy, when they feel that something is going great, and yet the MFM is telling them that they have lowish fluid, if they feel that they got an intuition that the baby seems to be fine, because they're in communication with that baby, we are not.
Right. Yeah.
They should trust that to the most part. Again, we've sort of had that beaten out of us as well. We've had trusting our own instincts beaten out of us, which benefits the system, not the individual. But yes, I have heard so many stories from women that have talked to me through the years where they've called me and they said, you know, I'm just not feeling right. And I said, well, okay, then come on in and we'll figure it out.
Yes, that's right, as well.
And even if I can't find anything wrong, the idea that they got listened to, yeah, and that someone took them seriously, and that they were reassured that there is nothing that we can find that's wrong, is a huge bonus to them.
Yeah.
To not be listened to and to be disrespected is probably one of the worst things that you can do to somebody.
Yeah.
To dismiss them. You know, the patented line that says, well, what medical school did you go to? You know, or did you look at Dr. Google? You know, that's meant to be insulting. But what it really is an insecurity on the part of the person that's listening to that question. Because if you are a human being, you want to treat somebody like you'd want to be treated yourself. And you would never want to be dismissed like that. Mm-hmm. So yes, maternal intuition has great value, and women just need to listen to it more and stand up for themselves. Yeah.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I'm going to have my son on the podcast to talk about his quarter life crisis. And he's a philosopher. And he's like, intuition isn't real. And I'm like, let's get on the podcast and talk about that, Leroy. We're going to see. Because I believe for me, intuition was awoken the moment his head came out of my body. Like, it literally was like this massive download of a superpower that I just knew 100% he was fine. Covered in meconium, but I knew he was fine. And that knowing was so deep that it was like, oh my God, I wish I'd tuned into that during pregnancy. You know, it was so profound. So anyway, it's good. We'll get him on. We'll have the conversations. We'll see. We'll discuss our differences. And I think that's what we should all be doing, listening to people from the other side and having conversations.
Well said.
Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your work. We can't wait to have you out here in Australia, down under.
I'll see you in August then.
Yeah, we'll see you then.
Okay,
bye-bye. Bye.
I'm Nadine Richardson, and you've been listening to The She Births Show. If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, share with a friend, and leave us a review. We'd love to know what you would like to hear more of. You can find me and my team of amazing doulas and educators at shebirths.com. and our awesome community on Instagram and Facebook. Within any good app store, you can download our free pregnancy guide via She Births, two separate words and plural, as well as access a range of online courses. Remember, when it comes to having a better birth, an easier transition into parenthood, your education is your empowerment. Don't forget to check out the catalogue of previous podcasts, and thank you for tuning in today. I hope you enjoyed the show.